And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. Spawning season for horseshoe crabs in the Delaware Bay estuary and Cape May shoreline is coming to a close, ending the annual natural phenomenon of beaches clogged with the prehistoric creatures, often attached in an eons-old mating ritual. Darting around them and snapping up their eggs from the sand are endangered red knots, a bird whose existence is intertwined with the horseshoe crab's success. So this hour, we'll check in on the health of these two fascinating species and why they're so important to the Delaware Bay ecosystem. Joining us will be red knot experts Lawrence Niles, wildlife biologist with Conservative Wildlife Foundation of New Jersey, and Amanda Day, a principal zoologist for the State of New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. They are co-authors, along with Joanna Berger, of Life Along the Delaware Bay, Cape May, Gateway to a Million Shorebirds. It is a beautifully produced book. We want to welcome both of you to Radio Times. And we'll also be talking with Daniel Hernandez. Daniel is Associate Professor of Biology at Richard Stockton College of New Jersey and Principal Researcher of the Delaware Bay Horseshoe Crab Spawning Survey. Daniel, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you.
So let's, for those of us who are non-scientists like myself, let's begin by just sort of geographically setting the scope of where we are talking about. What does the Delaware Bay estuary include and how big is it?
Well, the Delaware Bay estuary is, of course, the Delaware Bay shores of New Jersey and Delaware, and that's the main spawning areas for horseshoe crabs. That's the breeding season, but in the non-breeding season, the crabs come out of Delaware Bay and go out onto the ocean shelf off of New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. So they don't acknowledge state boundaries. They do wander out into the continental shelf, and that's where they spend the winter. Mm-hmm. And then again in the spring, they migrate into the Delaware Bay.
And tell us about what the spawning process is actually like for the horseshoe crab.
So the crabs will come ashore in usually the end of April and through the month of May. And females will come ashore to lay their eggs, and they dig down about 6 inches or so into the sand, lay their eggs. The males will attach to the females to fertilize the eggs. And then the females will do that maybe two or three times in one season. And then, you know, as Mandy said, then they move back, eventually move out to the Atlantic shelf again.
And Dan Hernandez, how many eggs are we talking about here typically?
It can range anywhere from 150,000 eggs per square meter to as little as zero on some beaches.
Wow. So how are, if these eggs are in the sand, right, they're sort of buried to some degree in the sand, how are these little delicate birds able to get to them?
It's actually interesting. They have, in addition to their visual job is looking for eggs as they're foraging, they also have chemosensors on the tips of their beaks, which allow them to find the eggs that are buried in the sand.
Wow. Mandy, tell us a little bit about the horseshoe crab. It's not a very attractive-looking creature, but tell us about it and why it's so important.
Well, I think one of the most fascinating things about horseshoe crabs is that they're over 425 million years old, older than dinosaurs, probably will be here, hopefully, well after we're gone, but they've managed to survive for that long, not by accident. I mean, they look like they pretty much wander up on the beach and not quite sure what they're doing. They get turned over by the surf and can't get themselves turned back over. But they must be doing something right. Females come up with one or two or three or four males surrounding her, and the more males that are surrounding her, the more of those males get to fertilize those eggs. So there's a lot of genetic diversity in those clutches of eggs. One female, I think, can lay up to about 80,000 eggs in a season, so that's a huge output. Mm-hmm. Most of those eggs don't survive to adulthood, and adulthood takes 9 or 10 years to achieve. So we're talking about a long-lived animal, and they've been very successful.
Yeah.
I think Delaware Bay is important because it's one of the places that's escaped a lot of development. A lot of our back bays along the Atlantic coast have been bulkheaded, so we've lost a lot of beach habitat, low-energy beach habitat where these animals can spawn. So yeah. It makes it unique for it. It's one of the largest populations of crabs in the Western Hemisphere, and I think in large part because the bay is so pristine.
And that brings us into really the crux of the problem, Larry, which is that we are seeing in some areas fewer and fewer of these eggs, which creates a problem then for the red knots that come and feed on those eggs for their migration. How did we get there?
Well, it's been a several decade old problem. The horseshoe crab was basically worthless back in the 80s, up until the 80s and early 90s. There was some use as bait for fishermen to catch minnows and eels, but then in the mid-90s it suddenly became valuable because it could be used as bait in the conch or whelk fishery, which was being caught and sold overseas. And so as soon as that whelk fishery started to spread down the Atlantic coast from New England into the mid-Atlantic states, and there was this sudden need for millions of crabs as bait, and most of the other populations had already been either lost or reduced to they're not easy to catch, and everybody focused on Delaware Bay. Within 3-4 years, the harvest had gone from a few hundred thousand to a few million. And because they don't breed until they're 9 years old, once you harvest them, it takes a long time to recover. And so the Delaware Bay population was practically decimated. But through our work and the work of other groups, it sort of stopped the harvest at a certain point, and that's where we are right now.
Yeah. Dan, can you address that as well? What efforts are underway to try to protect these eggs and try to prevent those things that have been happening to reduce the number of them?
Well, you know, there are things that we've done, like closed beaches and things like that, to try to protect spawning habitat. But, you know, the Delaware Bay is a very dynamic environment. It changes a lot. If there's storms, that can drastically alter the characteristics of the beaches and how the crabs lay their eggs. You know, if we're lucky and we have a nice spring like we did this season, we'll get nice high counts. If we get a particularly stormy season, we might not get the egg counts that we've gotten this year. And we see, you know, kind of cyclical types of numbers in eggs, but you know, the truth is that over the past decade there has been no real increase in horseshoe crab egg densities along Delaware Bay, at least on the New Jersey side.
Trace, I want to add that the horseshoe crab is would have been successful anyway. It's really what we're trying to do is not so much protect the crab itself, because it can persist, but there has to be a certain density of crabs to make it a useful for the migratory shorebirds, because you have to have a certain number of crabs so that they actually dig up the eggs of crabs that have already laid. And so then those eggs are on the surface of the beach, and then the birds are feeding on them. So that requires a lot more crabs than if you're just trying to protect crabs. Right. So that's where the problem is. A lot of the fisheries organizations are about just protecting the fishery, in this case, the crab. In our case, we want that fishery a lot higher so that it'll support the shorebirds as well.
Well, and let's talk about the shorebirds, and particularly the red knots, who are so dependent on these eggs. Mandy, tell us about them, about their amazing migration, and how they are so interdependent with the horseshoe crabs.
Well, shorebirds in general, there's 6 species that rely on Delaware Bay. Red knot is one of them, but red knots migrate some of the longest distances, almost pole to pole, from Tierra del Fuego, South America, to the Canadian Arctic to breed. And on their way, they stop on Delaware Bay. Now, those big flights require birds to gain weight before they lift off from South America. They fly across the ocean. They're burning off all their muscle, or rather all of their fat, and even some muscle to get to Delaware Bay. So they arrive in pretty emaciated condition. The eggs are soft. They're full of fat and protein. They're easily found, and just like eating peanuts, you can eat them as quickly as you can pick them up off the beach, and that's what makes it such a valuable food resource. The birds can digest them easily as well. Instead of the hard shell prey, which they eat most of the rest of the year, these eggs are just very easy to digest and put on fat very quickly. Yeah. So it's that abundant food resource at the right time in their migration, when they're in a very physically compromised situation, that makes Delaware Bay so special and horseshoe crab eggs so important.
Wow. And is it true that they can double their weight when they make their stopovers in Delaware and Jersey?
Yes, they can. I think the most weight we've ever documented is birds gaining 15 grams of weight a day. Imagine if you were a 100-pound person gaining 15 pounds a day. That would be a pretty astonishing physical feat.
And then you would have to indeed fly to the North Pole to work all of that off.
That's right. If you could even get off the ground.
Exactly.
But Tracy, just to give you an idea, a red knot needs to eat about 30,000 eggs a day while it's here, every single day, in order to make weight to get to the Arctic.
Wow. So hence the needs for so many, many of these eggs, if one bird can consume that many.
Exactly.
So then what's the concern as it relates to the birds and perhaps not being able to get enough of these eggs to maybe make it all the way to the North Pole, or we're losing them because they just don't have enough fuel to go on? What are the consequences of that? I mean, we can see the consequences of the reduced amount of eggs with the horseshoe crabs, but then what happens with the birds when they're not able to get enough of them?
Well, see, what we've seen through the years, because it's been going on for a long time, is that if birds get off the bay in inadequate condition, say they're leaving instead of 180 grams, they're going at 150 grams, they either can't make it to the Arctic, they may die on the way, or they may get to the Arctic and they can't breed. So that these are relatively long-lived birds. They could live up to 50. We have one bird called B95 that's lived to 18 years old. It's flown the distance from here to the moon. It's on its way back. But those kinds of birds, if they're inadequately prepared, then they either die or they can't breed, and then ultimately the population starts to decline. And so that's what's happened to the knot and other shorebirds. Gradually the populations are coming down until they're at the point where they can survive on the eggs that exist. That's why we're doing our best to try to increase the number of horseshoe crabs, because we have to have that increase before we could have the increase in the other shorebirds, and red knots and the other shorebirds.
So then what are the consequences as far as the ecosystem goes of losing those, the red knots and the other birds? I mean, certainly extinction is always the big concern, but then are there ripple effects in the ecosystem because of that?
Of course. I mean, I always give the example to my students of, imagine you're sitting on a hammock, and I went through with a scissor and I tried to cut a string at random here and there. Well, if I just cut one of those strings at random or a couple of those strings at random, you'd still stay on your hammock. If I went and started cutting more and more and more strings at random, eventually the hammock would give and you would fall through. An ecosystem's the same way. You take a link out here, a link out here, a link out here. Before you know it, the whole thing collapses.
Yeah. Well,
In part, this is also about the management of Delaware Bay. Delaware Bay is a truly unique habitat in the East Coast. It's one of those rare places where everything's intact. The Delaware Bay is in better condition now than it was 50 years ago. The water quality is better. The habitat is more protected. And so what we're losing in terms of horseshoe crabs is happening in other fisheries. And so we solve one, we could end up solving a lot of the other problems.
Well, that's what we'll be talking about when we come back on Radio Times. We'd love to hear your questions at 888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
The Heart Institute of Doylestown Hospital supports WHYY. Their cardiac specialists are dedicated to redefining what quality means to heart patients. By combining advanced treatments like cryoablation and minimally invasive valve surgery with responsive nursing care, Doylestown Heart Specialists strive to deliver shorter hospital stays, fewer complications, and the best possible outcomes. Doylestown Hospital, committed to serving heart patients with quality and compassion. Full details at dh.org. That's dh.org.
Hey, I'm Jad.
I'm Robert.
We make the show Radiolab,
which is mostly a show just for your ears.
But not anymore. Because coming soon to the Kimmel Center's Academy of Music...
A very different kind of Radiolab.
Yeah, eyeballs dancing.
Astronauts sizzling.
Holy cow.
Blind men yelling.
Sultan, you are trying to impose a visual totalitarianism upon the human brain.
Join us for Radiolab Live June 29th. Details are at radiolab.org/inthedark.
Master's degrees that teach students the critical skills for emerging professions in the natural and social sciences.
Degrees in environmental sciences, medical physics, applied positive psychology, applied geosciences, and the liberal arts draw on Penn's research specialties. Part-time options and evening classes for some degrees are designed to fit the needs of working professionals. Details online by searching Penn LPS, a proud supporter of WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Musk-Hawain. We are talking about horseshoe crabs and red knots and assorted other birds that feed on those horseshoe crab eggs and how critically important that is to the delicate balance of the ecosystem, and we're talking specifically about the Delaware Bay estuary. We've got a trio of scientists who are helping us to understand how critical this is and what needs to be done. We're talking with Larry Niles. He is a scientist for Conservative Wildlife of New Jersey, served as chief of the Endangered and Non-Game Species Program of the state of New Jersey. Mandy Day is with us as well. She is principal zoologist for the state of New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection's Fish and Wildlife Division's Endangered and Non-Game Species Program. Now, I dare you to say that four times fast. I don't know how you remember that, Mandy. We also have with us Dan Hernandez, who is Associate Professor of Biology at Richard Stockton College of New Jersey, and he has conducted extensive research into shorebirds and especially horseshoe crabs on the New Jersey beaches of Delaware Bay, including surveys of horseshoe crab eggs. Dan, welcome back to Radio Times.
Tracy, can I say I'm from Conserve Wildlife, not Conservative Wildlife?
Did I say conservative? You know what? We did politics last hour, and I think I've got politics on the brain, so let's make that clarification, shall we? He wants to conserve. That is the word of the hour. So we're talking about this delicate balance, and we've talked about some of the shorebirds and the 9,000-mile migration in the case of the red knots that they make and how they stop in the Delaware Bay estuary to feed on these horseshoe eggs and why there is a need for so many of them for them to be able to refuel and make that journey. I want to go back a little bit, Dan, to the horseshoe crabs and to their importance medically, because from what I understand, their blood also is important to medical science, correct?
Yes, that's correct. There's a compound called limulus amebocyte lysate. Say that one three times fast. LAL for short. And essentially, it's a tool used in the pharmaceutical industry to test for bacterial contamination. It's the standard test that the FDA uses for anything that's injectable, from insulin to vaccines, titanium pins, pacemakers. Anything that goes in your body is tested with horseshoe crab blood. Prior to that, they had to use bunnies, rats, overnight cultures, things like that. The horseshoe crab test takes a couple minutes and it's done.
And then, Dan, does that have a detrimental effect, though, on the population of these horseshoe crabs?
Well, the pharmaceutical industry is essentially mining gold at the public's expense, because they're mining all of these horseshoe crabs, using them, and then either returning them in bled condition or in poorer condition in which they were picked up, but they don't provide anything back towards the resource. So that's one of the big problems with the industry, is that they're making a multi-million dollar business off of our ecosystem.
I want to invite our listeners to join us in our conversation. Do you happen to see red knots or perhaps horseshoe crabs on the Delaware Bay? Tell us about what you're seeing and what questions you might have for our trio of scientists who are joining us. The number is 888-477-9499. And Mandy and Larry, I'd like you to take us to work with you and give us a sense of what it's like to go to these beaches. I mean, you've tagged some of these birds. Tell us what your work is like and what it is that you most want to accomplish in what you're doing there. Mandy, I'll start with you.
Well, our main busy season just passed. It's May through early June, and that's when birds start arriving on Delaware Bay. We have a few key studies that we carry out each May, and mainly we're catching and marking red knots, ruddy turnstones, and sanderlings. Those are three of the species that rely on the bay. We put a little leg flag on each bird with an individual alphanumeric code. We weigh them, because that's one key piece of information. We want to know if they're making weight throughout the season. And so we repeat those captures five or six times throughout the season to just see generally how the birds are progressing, if they're gaining adequate weight. We're also using those little markers when birds come back year after year. We could recite them with a spotting scope and calculate a population size and their survival. Mm-hmm. So those are key measurements to understanding if the birds are actually recovering on the bay or if they're declining further or not changing at all.
Must be exciting when you see them come back around.
It is exciting and anxiety-producing all at the same time because you never know. Every year is different on Delaware Bay.
Yeah. We have a team of researchers that are part paid professional and part volunteers from all over the world. So we have sometimes when we go out on the beach to catch, we'll have 20, 30 people to manage in that. So, you know, we catch through the use of cannon nets, and so it's very dangerous process, but the outcome is that we could catch all the birds that we need in one sample, and so we could do the work that Manny talked about. So then when we catch, it's like trying to organize 20, 30 people and, you know, a few minutes into teams and then trying to do all the work. So it's pretty stressful.
A little bit of chaos.
Yeah.
Well, I want to go to the phones because we've got some people who want to talk with all of you. We'll start off in Wilmington, Delaware, and we'll bring Matt in on our conversation. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I'm former president of Delaware Audubon Society, and I've worked a lot on these issues. And hello to Larry. And I think it's great you're pointing this out. We need to know much more about the red knots. And, of course, if we can save this species, it would bode well for some others that are in tenuous situations like the red knot.
The red knot is really, it's getting all the love because we do a lot of work on it. We've figured out how many birds are on the wintering areas, and we've, you know, gone to the Arctic and studying them there. But coming to the Delaware Bay, there are six different species, and major portions of all those species populations rely on Delaware Bay. And some are like the knot, where it's just 100,000. Now there's only 15,000 birds, but some are a lot more birds to start with, but they're all declining. And so if we don't do something about the bay's ability to carry these populations, then the red knot is really just going to be the first species that will show damage. Right behind the knot are ruddy turnstones and semi-palmated sandpipers and other species.
Yeah. What do they look like, red knots?
Well, they're a fat robin. That's what they remind me of. But yeah, beautiful salmon color, breast and face, and just a gorgeous silver and black spangled back. And you have to shake your head and say, well, how is this good for them when they're in the Arctic trying to breed and be cryptic and not be seen? But those colors are amazingly cryptic up in the Arctic with the light that's up there. Yeah, you would never believe it, but they blend right into the landscape.
Yeah, wow. I mean, you could be looking at the tundra and be staring right at a nest that's 10 feet in front of you and you wouldn't see it.
Oh, my.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So surprising because they are, having seen the pictures, they're so distinctive looking.
Yeah.
So we'll go back to the phones and, we'll jump in on the turnpike and bring Doug into our conversation. Hi there, Doug. Welcome to Radio Times.
How are you? Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about the diet needs of the red knot as they migrate north out of the Delaware Bay. They're traveling primarily over land. Do they stop at the Great Lakes or the Hudson Bay area for additional sustenance and food?
It's a good question because we've put little devices on red knots called geolocators that are not transmitters. They just record light, and with light you can figure out the position like you would with a sextant. And we recapture those birds, and we've gotten 40 of these geolocators back so that we could track the flight of individual birds through the year when we put it on and when we recaptured them. And we were surprised to find that nearly every knot that left Delaware Bay went to James Bay or to a place on Hudson's Bay called Nelson River that no one even knew it was a shorebird stopover. And we don't actually know why they're there. Like, are they just staging there to go on to the Arctic waiting for the right weather? Or are they eating there as well? We think it's the staging because there's, in the Hudson Bay, it's still cold there. But we think that once they leave the bay, they can't eat. They get to the Arctic, they can't eat. And then after a week or so in the Arctic, then things start to thaw, and then they can start feeding on insects.
Wow. So it really is one-stop shopping when they come through the Delaware Bay. I mean, this is it.
That speaks to the importance of it.
Yeah,
that's right.
Absolutely.
That's right. Imagine landing in the Arctic when it's still frozen without a jacket and without food and having to survive for a week or so. So that's, I think that's what these guys are looking at.
Wow. We'll go to North Cape May, and we'll bring Ellen in on our conversation. Hi, Ellen. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I have spent years walking up and down the Delaware Bay on the New Jersey side, turning over crabs and anxiously counting and looking for the red knots and the piping plovers and all the other birds. Laughing gulls are particularly noticeable. And the birds seemed very light this year. I don't know if that's just because I'm not out on the right day or the right time, or if they're more of a decline this year than in the last, like, four or five.
Hmm. Mandy?
When you say light, do you mean thin, Ellen?
Yeah, thin. Fewer birds, especially small birds. Even the laughing gulls seem to be down in number this year.
Well, I think maybe what you were saying, because it was a good season this year, actually. We had calm weather. There was spawning over more beaches. What you may have seen was birds spread out over a larger area because there was more food available in more places. So I think in terms of weight gains, we haven't looked at all of the data yet, but it looks pretty good this year for red knots, sanderlings, ruddy turnstones all seem to be gaining adequate weight. So I think what you have probably witnessed is birds spreading out rather than concentrating in those food hotspots that sometimes occur when you have bad weather and all the spawning happens inside of creek mouths rather than spread out on beaches.
I mean, we were actually elated with this year's. I mean, it was a good season for red knots and for red knot biologists.
And Dan, is that reason to be optimistic going forward? Is there still reason to, you know, take a lot of precaution here? It sounds like this has been a good year, but as Mandy pointed out a few minutes ago, we don't know one year to the next.
That's absolutely right. You know, you can't take, one year or even a couple of years as a sign of a real recovery until you have a longer period of time and you actually see the population come up. But yeah, it's definitely worrisome. You know, imagine an oil spill here in the Delaware Bay during the middle of the spawning season. You'd kill all the crabs and all the birds in one shot.
Yeah. We'll go next to Newtown Square, and we'll bring Linda in on our conversation. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
My question is, we see a lot of the seagulls eating the eggs, and it seems to me, we talk about the migrating birds, but the seagulls must eat a lot of those eggs. So just a curiosity, is that a problem?
Hmm. Well, most of the gulls, a lot of them were at a place that we called Moore's Beach, and we had really high egg densities at that particular beach this year, again, because it was nice and calm because of, you know, features of the habitat, low-energy beach. And egg densities were increasing steadily week after week during the stopover period, despite the fact that it was completely overrun with laughing gulls. So laughing gulls, in this case, I think were feeding in other areas than where the red knots were hanging out.
And if I could
We're at the Villas, New Jersey, up the bay.
Yeah, I think
lots of seagulls.
Well, I could just add to that the laughing gulls do eat a lot of eggs, but it's worthwhile to note that the New Jersey Division of Fish and Wildlife has been doing counts of gulls since the 70s, and we have not seen an increase in their populations. What sometimes you see is gulls, because they're bigger, it's sort of the big dog eats first principle. They'll get into those hot spots where food's available and exclude shorebirds. But in years where there's lots of eggs or when crabs are restored and there's plenty of food for everyone, then everyone gets to eat. It's an artificial situation that we've created now with the low horseshoe crab population and a much reduced horseshoe crab egg resource, and the gulls seem to be able to get there first.
Yeah, see, I think this goes to your question, Tracy, earlier about the ecosystem. The horseshoe crabs were a keystone species for a wide variety of ecosystem effects. And one of them was supporting the laughing gull population, which is centered in New Jersey. So we think there's a lot of laughing gulls here, but we're actually the center of the breeding population of laughing gulls. But there are other species that are feeding on horseshoe crab eggs. So that when horseshoe crab numbers went down, there was a widespread impact on the Delaware Bay that we don't really know what the entire impact is, but we do know that a lot of fish populations are failing, a lot of other breeding bird populations are falling. And so there could have been all these knock-on effects on other species.
Yeah, such a delicate balance all the way around. By the way, you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, WHYY.org, member-supported public media. We go back to the phones to Quakertown and Kathy. Welcome, Kathy, to Radio Times.
Hi, Larry and Nancy. This is Kathy Lieber, United Friends School. My question is, how has or has climate change in the Arctic affected the survival of the chicks that do hatch? Is there a problem with synchronicity of the immersion of the insects as their food source?
That's a good question, Kathy. It's more complicated than that, of course. For example, there's been about 6-7 years of really low lemming populations in the Arctic through the 2001 to 2008. 2007, and so when there's low prey like lemmings, that means all the predators are going after bird nests, and so there was probably impacts of that. Now that long run of low lemming populations is very likely to be climate change related. The more serious impact is that all the birds are breeding here have to sort of move north as the climate warms. And the Arctic breeders can't go any further north, so you're basically, everything's pushing them out.
Well, the other piece of this is, and we've seen this in on fall migrants, when birds are heading back south, is higher incidences of storms. And in the Arctic, I got to believe a late snowstorm in the spring could knock out productivity as well. We don't know if that's happening, but it's certainly changeable. Weather patterns can certainly make the Arctic a lot more unpredictable.
Well, before we go to our break, I want to ask you, Daniel, about something that I saw that was interesting. There is one thing to, you know, taking one's work home with them, but I did hear something about you growing baby horseshoe crabs on your kitchen table. Is that correct? And what can you tell us about that?
I have a very loving and patient wife.
Indeed.
I've been known to do things like that. You know, growing them out just to do it to show students. We do all the egg surveys using Richard Stockton College students, actually. So I usually grow them as a means to demonstrate to the students the development of the horseshoe crabs. And it ends up being on my kitchen.
Well, that's got to be interesting. Do you do that all the time? I mean, is it an ongoing thing for you and for your students? Or is it something that you just do, you know, in season? Or how does that work?
Year-round, actually. I tend to look at a lot more esoteric things in my spare time. Mandy and Larry are obviously busy managing and doing other things, but as an academic, I have a little bit of more freedom to pursue other scientific appetites. So I tend to do little experiments like that. And, you know, we've been working with, for instance, the Adventure Aquarium in Camden, growing out baby horseshoe crabs to try to head start them so that we can reduce mortality.
Oh, interesting. Well, we'll have much more to talk about when Radio Times comes back. We'd love to hear from you. Are you seeing red knots, horseshoe crabs, as you go down the shore this summer? Tell us what you're seeing at 888-477-9499, and Radio Times will be right back.
Natural Lands Trust supports WHYY. With the help of its members, Natural Lands Trust has preserved more than 100,000 acres of the region's most beautiful landscapes. Information about how your support can keep our communities green for future generations and details about outings, volunteer opportunities, and nature preserves are available at natlands.org. Natural Lands Trust. Land for life.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird!
It's a plane!
It's Superman!
Yes, on the next Fresh Air, a biography of Superman and his creators. We talk with Larry Tye about his new book, Superman. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
And who, disguised as Clark Kent,
mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper, fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice.
The glass is half full or half empty. Which is it? Our outlook on life reflects the need to experience pleasure and danger. When the two are in balance, everything's pretty good. When one's too strong, there can be trouble, like addiction, anxiety, or depression. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, understanding the nature and nurture of optimism and pessimism. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Musk-Owain. We are talking about horseshoe crabs this hour, and perhaps you see them as you go down the shore, as you take part in summer activities all throughout the Delaware Bay estuary. We're talking about the relationship between those horseshoe crabs and their eggs, and the red knots and the many, many other birds that come and feed off those eggs on their way to places far and wide, and how delicate that balance is. The concern is that we've seen drops in the number of eggs that have been available that then can create drops in the number of red knots and other birds that rely on those eggs, and just really a fascinating mix and intertwining and interdependency in that ecosystem. We have a trio of scientists who are helping us to understand how delicate that balance is and what needs to be done to keep everything in place. We have been talking with Larry Niles, who is a scientist for Conserve Wildlife of New Jersey and served as chief of the Endangered and Non-Game Species Program of the state of New Jersey. Mandy Day is with us, the principal zoologist for the state of New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection's Fish and Wildlife Division's Endangered and Non-Game Species Program. That is quite a title. I don't even know how you get all that on a business card. Daniel Hernandez is with us as well. He is the assistant professor of biology at Richard Stockton College of New Jersey. He has conducted extensive research into shorebirds and especially horseshoe crabs on the New Jersey beaches of Delaware Bay, including surveys of horseshoe crab eggs during the springs of 2005 through 2009. He has also grown some of these baby horseshoe crabs on his own kitchen table, thanks to his wife's patience. So, with all that said, we want to invite our listeners to join us in our conversation. The number is 888-477-9499, and a question did come in during the break for our guests, and it goes like this: how can we as citizens put pressure on pharma companies to contribute to the revitalization of the crab population, and how can we help as well? And that question comes from a listener in Mount Airy.
Well, I think that's a really great question, because the use of crabs as bait is a bad way to value an animal, because it's only valuable when it's dead. But the uses for its blood is, if it's done correctly, leads to a very small mortality, and that blood is valuable to humans. It's valuable. That the drug lysate is several hundred million dollar industry, and most of that money is not going back to horseshoe crabs or to the people of Delaware Bay. Most of the money being made is with the drug companies and companies outside the Delaware Bay. So we want to try to realign that so that make the extraction of blood from crabs a vital part of their management, so that the drug companies, the people of this area, have the incentive to restore the crab population. If we could bring it back to what it once was, which could be double or three times the number of crabs that now exist, then there would be plenty of crabs to provide lysate, as well as crabs for the shorebirds and all the other uses. We're just trying to get that incentive right that would create a sustainable use of the crabs over the next generation.
And what kind of efforts are you seeing, if any, in that regard? Is anyone working on that at the moment?
Well, I like to think, you know, as a professor, you kind of are doing that. Every year we've had about 10 interns coming in, and they get to work with the scientists. They get to go on catches. And, you know, every one of those students takes that memory with them and passes it on. Some of them have continued on even into the same field, into conservation. So I think, you know, by teaching people And, you know, having radio programs like this where we discuss these issues, bringing them to the public eye, that's definitely helpful.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the phones to Hillsborough, and we'll welcome Cindy to Radio Times. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. Good morning. Hi, I'd like to follow up on that last question about how to get the pharmaceutical companies to be more contributory to this. This reminds me of a situation with animals, pet cats and dogs, that need blood for blood transfusions. And years ago, blood was harvested from dogs in the pound. And there was a lot of pressure to stop that practice from animal rights groups. And eventually, the response of the veterinary community was to create blood banks using pet dogs and a blood mobile that would go around and collect blood in exchange for, you know, a biscuit or whatever the arrangement made was. But they recognized that they had a need for a blood product, and they developed a very friendly way to harness the animal community. And I wonder if enough people were concerned about this, that the pharmaceutical company could respond in some sort of proactive fashion, whether it was to develop aquaculture for horseshoe crabs or guidelines for sustainable catch and release or something like that. I think the public pressure is what's sort of missing in the equation, but I think something like that could happen.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think we're at the point where we really need to bring these folks to the table, and the public really could be the key player in this. I think we know that crab blood is important for human health. The horseshoe crab population on the U.S. East Coast provides 90% or more of the world supply of lysate, and that demand is increasing by 20% per year. So we're really at a point where we need to turn this thing around. I think the suggestions you made are quite good. New guidelines on handling, holding times, how much blood is taken from crabs. We can do this a lot better than we are. And certainly, and it's only my opinion that I'm sure it would hurt the drug company's bottom line to be able to put new standards in place and be able to come to the table and make this happen. So, this is certainly an example of a very sustainable industry that could be done well. The crabs could fare well, humans would fare well, and certainly the birds would benefit. But public will is one of the most important elements here.
We've been doing, this year, in fact, we working with Manomet Center for Conservation Science and Enviro Media, we did a lot of work trying to understand how people within 30 miles of the Delaware Bay Shore feel about the Bay Shore, about the bay, about crabs. And the whole purpose of this work is to help us figure out a way to get the public more involved. So one possibility is Glenn Gauvery in Delaware has this program called Flip a Crab, where they just go, he has volunteers that go out on the beaches and they just turn crabs over that have been flipped over by the waves. So these crabs will often die or get eaten by gulls or whatever. And so his group is flipping over crabs so that it saves their lives. Like, we're thinking about those kind of programs to try to get the public more immediately involved in these issues.
Yeah, and sometimes it's something as simple as that to raise public awareness, to just get people involved on some level. We'll go to Bristol next, and Norman. Welcome, Norman, to Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello, can you hear me?
We sure can.
My question is, has anybody thought of synthesizing the eggs from foodstuffs and from, with modern chemistry today, one can put together, we humans eat a lot of synthetic foods, in a sense. I mean, they're real foods, but they're made to seem like something that they're not. Has anybody tried to synthesize those eggs? And if you can do that, you could then have an unlimited supply of food for the birds.
It's a good question, because it's the first thing that many people think of to protect the migration. The problem is that, and it's been tried, so some researchers have put food out on the beaches that essentially shorebird chow, and really just fed the gulls. and the more you put out, the more gulls come in. So it doesn't necessarily benefit the shorebirds. But I think the more important issue is that, as we said before, this is a ecosystem-wide effect. The collapse of horseshoe crabs, the loss of eggs have affected not just shorebirds, but fish that are eating the eggs. We talked about gulls. There's any number of glossy ibis, all kinds of species that are in one way or another connected to this huge event, this crab spawn that occurs every year. And we can't just replace that by putting food out in the beach. It's better to just fix it. I mean, we live, and this is a vibrant wild system right in the heart of this megalopolis, and it deserves our attention. We can fix this.
Yeah. Are there differences in the way that New Jersey approaches this as opposed to Delaware's approach when it comes to preserving and protecting these eggs?
Slight differences, but let me just say that New Jersey and Delaware have really stepped forward and have taken the lead on the conservation of crabs and shorebirds. My counterpart in Delaware, Kevin Kalis, and Karen Bennett, have been doing the similar work that we do in New Jersey, catching and banding birds. It's the exact same research program on both sides of the bay, so it's truly a collaborative effort in that way. And they have been since 1997 for the last 15 years, as well as same time frame we have. But New Jersey stepped forward with a legislated moratorium in 2008. Prior to that, we had a two-year voluntary moratorium. Delaware had voluntarily reduced its harvest quotas down to 100,000 male crabs, hand harvest only. So it's a clean harvest. We know we're not getting females, breeding mm-hmm. females in that harvest. And I think Delaware actually tried to have a moratorium as well, but they were taken to court and it was overturned. So I think the states of Delaware Bay really have taken this seriously, taken a lead in shorebird and crab conservation. Other states surrounding us haven't been quite as aggressive in that conservation bent, but we're working on it.
Dan Hernandez, I actually like all of you to answer this before we wrap up the program. Where are some good spots if we want to see red knots, we want to see horseshoe crabs and the like? What are your favorite places to do that?
I mean, hands down, Reed's Beach is one of the best places to go. You have the nice long jetty, you have plenty of birds there. I'd suggest to somebody who wants to go out and have an adventure, go out to Moore's Beach. It's an exciting 1 mile trek out through an old cratered road, and it's worth it at the end, though. You get to see plenty of crabs and birds and stuff.
I agree. For most people, Reed's Beach has been the center of the crab spawn and shorebird activity these last few seasons. You can see flocks of 10, 20,000 birds flying around. But in Delaware, there's the Mispillion Harbor, which actually has a center, and the Mispillion Center. And so that also is a great place to view the spectacle in its entirety in just one place.
And where are these beaches located within those states? Where's Reed's in Jersey?
Reed's is like directly across from Stone Harbor on the Atlantic mm-hmm. coast. It's on the Delaware Bay coast side. And Mispillion Harbor is just south of Dover.
And there's also a great spot is Kimball's Beach, which is part of the Cape May National Wildlife Refuge. That's another good spot that you can go to.
Okay. So as you look forward now, you've just finished your busy season, as Mandy pointed out. What are we watching for going forward? What kinds of numbers are you looking to see? What's next in this process?
Well, we certainly rely on winter area counts for red knots to see. It's more of a census because the birds are in place and they're stable and they're staying there, so we can get a really good count. That's one thing we'd be looking to see. If those numbers increase, then we'd start to have more confidence that Delaware Bay, the good luck we've had this season, might actually be producing a real population increase.
Yeah. I think the other number, very important for us, is the results of there's a sampling trawl out on the Atlantic coast that measures horseshoe crab populations. And that's been going on for 10 years, and that's basically been flat for the last 10 years. What we want to see is that go up.
A spike.
And we haven't seen that yet. But that's the number we're looking at.
And the same with horseshoe crabs. Over the past 10 years, it's basically flat. We're looking for an increase now. And, you know, this year, last year, we're looking pretty good, but it's still too early to tell.
Yeah. If the numbers do go down, next time, then what?
You know, egg numbers can vary, again, by year, so by such a large degree that luck plays a big part of it.
Mm. And if horseshoe crab numbers don't improve, you know, I think it just speaks to the losses that are still occurring, either from, certainly from bait harvest, maybe from mortality from lysate, but perhaps illegal losses that we're just not reckoning at this point.
Yeah.
I think everybody's going to suffer. I mean, the whole bleeding industry is going to be a problem. The bait industry is going to be a problem. But from our perspective also, red knot is the first on the list. If things don't start improving, then you could reasonably expect that there will be other species that will be listed and facing extinction.
Yeah, and then you've got the domino effect with all the others.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, we have had a wonderfully interesting discussion about the ecosystem in the Delaware Bay estuary. We have been talking with three scientists, and I want to thank each of you. Larry Niles has been with us, a scientist for Conserve Wildlife of New Jersey, served as chief of the Endangered and Non-Game Species Program of the state of New Jersey. Thank you so much for being with us. Amanda Day has been with us as well. She's the principal zoologist for the State of New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection's Fish and Wildlife Division's Endangered and Non-Game Species Program. Thank you, Mandy, for being with us.
It's been a real privilege. Thank you.
And, of course, Daniel Hernandez, who happens to just grow these eggs on his kitchen table, but when he's not doing that, he is assistant professor of biology, associate professor of biology, at Richard Stockton College of New Jersey and has conducted extensive research into these things. Thank you so much, Dan, for being with us, and to all of you for just helping us to get a better grasp of what this ecosystem looks like and what the needs are and what we need to be thinking about going forward to maintain that balance. Thank you so much. Well, I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin, and our producers are Dennis Devine, Patty McMahon, Susan Greenbaum, and Debbie Builder. You've been listening to Radio Times on WHYY.